You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Hanging out with Clement
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Really excited this morning to be hanging out with the first citizen of the city of Johannesburg, Dr. Mpho Palatse. She's a medical doctor, she's a DA politician, the first democratically elected woman executive mayor for the city of Johannesburg, and she is on our hanging out feature this morning. Thank you for making time, Mayor. How are you?
I'm good. So excited to be here. It's been a while.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
The last time I spoke to you was when we were broadcasting live from Alex. I think it was in November last year. And at the time, you were still campaigning
to be
the mayor.
We were campaigning and I was debating
with Mpomerani.
And we were arguing about whether Alex Clinic is called Masakane or not.
Because he insisted that it wasn't.
Yes.
And then there were people from Alex who were calling in and saying, no, it was actually called that.
Yeah, that was quite hilarious.
That was an amazing outside broadcast. And I remember introducing you as the incoming Johannesburg mayor. So I prophesied.
Good call.
Yeah, I'm Prophet Papa Clement.
Yes.
So, auswa Pitori. What's Bulela's Pitori?
Yo, you know what? I've lost it because Joburg people laugh at you, hey?
Bulela's Pitori?
Yeah, like really? When you say things like, Gamshi, but you.
What is that?
Gamshi, and they laugh, and you become the laughing stock, literally. So,
yeah.
I moved to Joburg in 2011, so it's been just over 10 years.
Yeah.
And over the years, I decided I better lose this language or I'm going to be the laughing stock wherever I go.
Yeah.
And then you go home. And then Pretoria people, but uchaka kalilim. Yeah, they laugh at you. They're like, you Kim Puma Jose, you know? So you can't win, man. It's tough.
So you were born in Hebron in Pretoria, and then at some point ended up in Mabopane. You've lived with your grandmother during your early years. How was it growing up and being raised by your grandmother before you joined your parents? People always say those who are raised by grandmothers, like us, are well-behaved, well-disciplined.
I don't know. So one of the results of being raised by my grandma is that I hate tea to this day. So I've started drinking rooibos. So I drink rooibos now. I love it. It tastes lovely with lemon and ginger. But my grandmother used to force me to finish my tea before get crashing, you know. So I could not go to crash before finishing tea. And I used to cry literally every morning because I couldn't finish this big mug of tea. And then one of my older cousins bought me a tiny little cup as a compromise.
So
that's what I drank from. But I've got great memories. I mean, my grandmother died when I was quite young, but she was a lovely lady. I mean, I remember one day she caught a beautiful, colorful bird for me. So I still have those memories. I was very young. I mean, I moved in with my parents at age three. But I still have very fond memories of being with my grandmother.
That's incredible. So when you joined your parents, how different was it then? They were both teachers, right?
My parents were both educators. And you know what? It never stopped. The education never stopped. So my bedroom was a teaching lab. Literally everything was labeled. The door was labeled door. The wall was labeled wall. The cupboard, yes. So that's the kind of upbringing I had. I mean, I was looking at a photo of mine in school uniform, you know, the black and white primary school uniform. And I'm at home outside with a chalkboard writing. So this is when other kids were probably playing. And that's the kind of upbringing I had. So
how did you deal with that pressure? My mama was a teacher and she used to wake me up at like 3 a.m. to study because I felt like I had no excuse to fail. How did you deal with that pressure of being expected to do well? Because even outside of your family home, the people outside are like, Mama hai le papa hai are teachers.
Yes.
Like, what excuse do you have not to get it right? Did you feel that pressure and how did you deal with it?
Of course I felt it, but I didn't have a choice. I mean, they didn't give me a choice but to excel. And, you know, I mean, I'm grateful in hindsight that they put me under so much pressure. So my mom woke me up at 4, so I feel better. At least you were woken up at 3 because I thought my mom was abusing me. But,
I still believe she was abusing me.
Yeah, and if she comes back and you're sleeping, what would she do? Like, I'd feel like
a
shoe. No. She would throw a shoe
What's
at me.
What's in English?
Pinch.
To pinch.
Yeah.
She would pinch me, and it was painful.
They were hectic. No, those parents were hectic.
That was assault.
Yeah.
If it was today, I would open a case.
Do you know what I mean?
So, studying, was it chemical engineering at VETS? And then deciding to move to Asifako Makgatho, to Medunsa, to study medicine. Who influenced your choice of studying for that kind of, was it your parents who were always like, we need the serious, like either you're a teacher, engineer, or you become a doctor? Or did they give you space to, for instance, if you wanted to be an actress or you said, I want to be a politician, how would they have taken it?
I doubt they would have agreed.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think the education system at the time also chose for us. You know, at school back in the 90s, your subject choice was not really your choice. It was about your aptitude. So are you in the top 50% of the class?
Mm-hmm.
And if you are, then you're doing maths and science. Nobody asked you what you were interested in. You had no option to do history. So I wish I'd done history. Looking at where I am now, I think it would have benefited me a great deal. And I never did it because it was either history or maths. And it was really not about what you want to do, but it was about, are you good at maths? So you had to do maths. So I kind of feel like the system chose for us in a lot of ways. So yes, my parents gave me the space, but I think they also trusted the system because they knew the system would push me in a certain direction, which was quite unfortunate, I think.
Yeah. So at Wits, were you there for a year or 2 years?
So I was there for 2 years. So what happened was my guidance teacher in high school, her husband was a chemical engineer and they were very well off. And we all envied her lifestyle. You know, it was a girls only school and she used to always dress up in the fanciest clothes and she used to get cars for Mother's Day type thing.
What?
Yes. And we thought, okay, that's the life we want. And I just asked her what her husband did and she told me and I said, that's what I want to do. And she started helping me. So we started applying. We applied for bursaries. So I got a bursary. I got into Wits. And I realized actually my second year that I hated engineering and that it was a total mistake for me to go in that direction. But I didn't know then what I wanted to do. So my mom took me to the Department of Labor at the time where you could access an educational psychologist for free. And she put me through a battery of tests.
Mm.
And at the end of that, she said to me, you've got two options. You can either go into the health sciences, so either medicine, psychology, physiotherapy, OT, anything along those lines. Or you could go into business and you'll be both successful and happy, but you should never be an engineer. It's not who you are. It was a big mistake. So I felt vindicated that, yes, I'd wasted 2 years, but at least there was agreement that I'd made a mistake and I'd make a good call. I'd made a good call to make a U-turn.
Yeah, look at where you are now, right? And also how you've been able to serve the community as a doctor, even in communities like Alexander. And we'll talk more about that. We'll talk politics as well. We'll reflect on her time as the mayor of Johannesburg. It's tricky enough to be a mayor of one of the biggest cities, but it's even more tricky when you're leading a coalition government. So we'll reflect on that as well during our conversation. But I want to play one of your favorite songs, and then you'll tell me why this is so special to you. So I'm also a big fan of Elevation Worship.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was actually listening to their album at the gym yesterday. What is it about the song for you, The City Is Yours?
So, I mean, obviously talking about a city, and right now that's my domain of influence, is the city, right? So it's very close to my heart. But it talks about compassion. I mean, we had the late Dr. Don Matera's memorial service the other day. And one of the things he used to say is that compassion is the highest religion. And it's something I subscribe to. You can't serve people you don't love. And the song is saying, the city, Lord, it is yours. And it says, break our hearts for the people who are far from you. It says, teach us to love the way you loved us and send us out. So it's saying you can't go out and be the mayor or serve in whatever capacity if your heart's not broken for those people. And that's why we have things like corruption or people who take up positions for their own self-interest and they're not really concerned about the people who voted them into power. I think for me, it grounds me, this type of message. It reminds me of what it's all about.
Mm.
And it reminds me to cultivate my own compassion. It's not all the time that you naturally feel a love for people. I think you need to be intentional about cultivating it.
Mm-hmm.
And that for me serves as a good reminder of what it's really all about.
So a lot of people who, especially in the beginning stages of serving communities, of serving the public, always have this good heart. They are compassionate until they realize the power they have and the control of resources they have. So how do you protect yourself from that urge of wanting to abuse the resources? Because every single of us are capable of that, but you've got to be intentional about remembering why you are in the position you're in.
I think yes, either that or until it just gets too much, you know, until you get tired, you know, because it's a rough space, this. You get attacked daily. I mean, you get attacked by your own team. You get attacked outside your team. You get attacked on online platforms and everywhere. So that's the other times where you may feel like, okay, Lord, I'm good. Can I bounce? Can I go back to my normal life? But going back to your question, I think for me, again, it goes back to your value system as a person. And for me, that's what it is. I'm very spiritual. I've been open about it. And I believe you reap what you sow, you know, and I believe what you do to others, it will come back to you in some way, form or another. So it's self-defeating to do those kinds of things because it will catch up with you. Besides just the fact that it'll come back to you, there will be consequence. And we're seeing a lot of that. I mean, if you're talking about corruption in this country, there are many people who thought they were above corruption. We've seen the Zondo Commission expose a lot of things, and we're starting to see consequence, even though it's slow. But I believe that progressively we'll begin to see a criminal justice system that's really reactive and responsive, and that promotes or rather discourages people from going into those kinds of practices because there is consequence. So on the one hand, it's that. On the other hand, it's just my own personal belief system. It's not going to benefit me or my children if I sow the wrong seed. Somebody along my lineage will reap the fruits of my harvest.
And it may not be you at the time, but as you say, along your lineage, and that's what you need to start thinking about. It looks like you've always found yourself drawn towards serving people. Like when I look at the work you were doing, even in Alexandra, how you were championing the extension of service hours in clinics. Do you think medicine or politics was your calling?
I believe so, yes.
Both of them?
Yeah.
Not one over the other?
Mm-hmm. So I believe both at different times. So I believe that my medicine was a step in my preparation, and an important step in my preparation. I mean, I'm now in charge of an ailing city, which to me is like a sick patient. And a lot of the approaches that I use are borrowed from my medical training and my medical experience. You'll know that globally it's said that doctors have transferable skills. So whatever that we taught in medical school can actually be applied in various other sectors of life or industry. And it's so true, you know. So I, as much as it doesn't make sense at the time, it makes a lot of sense to me now why I had to go through both the training and the work as a medical doctor. I learned a lot from that. And even when I went into specializing, a lot of my colleagues would have gone into clinical specialties, but I knew that I'm going to serve the population and not necessarily individuals. And I went into population medicine, population health. So I did public health medicine, where your patient is the population as opposed to a single individual.
Who would you say taught you about the importance of service to the people?
I'd say various people along the way. Firstly, my parents. I mean, my parents were educators, but they were also parents not only to me. By the way, I'm an only child. But at no point in my life did it feel like I was alone, in the sense that there were always others. You know, whether it was the church that my parents were hosting for weekly prayer meetings or even church service when we didn't have a venue, whatever the case may be. You know, I've always been around a lot of people that my parents were somehow mothering, parenting. And so that sort of comes naturally to me, looking at my upbringing. But also, I mean, you would have had different mentors along the way, you know, whether it's at school, at church, in the community. I used to belong to a dance club, for instance, in high school. I did ballroom and Latin American dance, and we had Mama Dudu, you know. Mama Dudu was the owner of the club, and she was our aftercare mom. So after school, I'd go home, change, and go to dance, and she became the mother then. When we traveled to Sun City for a competition, she was the mother there. You know, and it was always a lot of us. And she took us away from trouble, and we were doing beautiful things, competing and feeling important and beautiful. And so, yeah, I think community has always been just everywhere, all around me.
Mm-hmm. And how are you transferring that teachings to your children? How many children are you? Three.
So I've got three kids. My eldest just turned 19.
Wow.
Yeah, he's playing cricket, and my middle one's 12. a boy as well. And my little one's 5. She's about to turn 6. My little girl, Kuma.
Yeah. I mean, being a mayor is a full-time job. And I asked you earlier, before we started the interview, like, do you find time to spend with them? Or do you sometimes take them along to work?
So, my little girl loves coming to the office, but I have to manage it because she takes over the space.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So my executive assistant knows. I always say, please indicate when is a good time for her to come because she loves people and people love her. So, you know, and I don't want her to be a distraction, but equally, I don't want to take the experience away from her. So we time it and we manage it. But yeah, she loves it. She goes into people's offices and she draws pictures of a city and she thinks like a mayor.
Oh, yeah?
You know? Yes, which is quite interesting. So my life has become our life, you know, but their life is also our life. So we'll support my eldest when he plays cricket, you know, we'll go and watch him if it's doable. Do you know what I mean? And that's how I do family. It's we celebrate each other's gifts and callings. We pray together. We pray for each other and we understand who each person is in the family and how we need to be praying and supporting for each of the people. So it's great. I really love doing family. I love doing life with my kids.
They're awesome. How do you protect them from, you said earlier that there are texts that come every day from whether it's even people you work with, people outside. Your son is 19. He reads. He's probably on social media. He knows what's going on. And sometimes you can only do so much as a parent to protect them from the information out there. How do you protect him? Do you sit down with him and explain the context of your job?
Yes, that's very important. But he's smart, you know. I mean, he surprises me sometimes as well. So my son was in boarding until matric, and this is first year out of school. And he would have had his own experiences with life. You know, he was head of spirit at his school in matric. So he would have had his own leadership challenges, his own politics, you know, and exposure to politics. Politics is everywhere. You'd be surprised how much politics is in schools as well. And so he's that smart. He understands. He gets it, you know, and interesting. I mean, he would also have friends who've had parents with similar backgrounds as well. And they talk, you know, they share. And sometimes he shares their stories with me. And I'm impressed to see how they're also talking to each other. And they're almost like a support group for each other. But I also rely on him to talk to me because some of the challenges he goes through because of my position, if he doesn't tell me, then I don't know. And I always appreciate his boys are tricky. Sometimes they close up. You know, they don't always talk, especially at that age. He's 19. So when he opens up to me and says, you know, I felt this way, or I felt that people perceived this way because of your position, and this is how it affected me, I always appreciate those moments that where we can say, okay, how do we deal with it, or how did you deal with it? Yeah, so talking is important.
Yeah, that's interesting. Is he a fighter? Is he a Democrat? Is he a Congolese?
Definite Democrat.
Is he a Democrat?
Yeah.
Not because of mommy, but because it's...
No, it's in him. I mean, my son is an ultimate socialite. Like I said, he was head of spirit at his school. So he's very people orientated and very good with people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, he's awesome.
Okay, cool. After the latest Tonight Witness News headlines, I want us to get into when you decided, okay, this is the time now to run as a DAPR councillor. It's time now to join the formal politics. We're going to get into that after the latest in Eyewitness News headlines. I see your calls, your WhatsApp voice notes as well. I'm going to get to them as well just after the news headlines. 011-883-0702. If you would still like to call, the WhatsApp line is 072-702-1702. It's exactly 10:30.
Hanging out with Clement on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
It's 25 minutes before 11 o'clock. We've got Dr. Mpopalatse, the mayor of the city of Johannesburg, on our Hanging Out feature this morning. And I'm going to make some time to go to your calls. Let me read some of the messages that have come through so far. Let's start here. Clement, what a wonderful lady. If only we had more of her in parliament. Can she not run for president? Johan, is that what you think about sometimes, Mayor?
People ask me such things all the time.
Yeah.
Like people are asking me now about 2024. Yeah. And I say one thing to them. You know, I'm here. I'm committed to the city. And yeah, I've not had any divine leading in any other direction, so I'm going to stay where I am until such happens.
Another SMS says, hey Clement, we salute people like the mayor May God continue to guide her, keep and protect her. Just know that your quest to make our beloved South Africa beautiful again is supported by most of us. Another anonymous says, "Nah, I personally love Mpo, love your work. Please clean up Joburg and continue to do that." And by the way, I'm an ANC voter. That's what anonymous says there. And then on Twitter, I also see your tweets that are coming through. Let me read some of them. I've got one tweet from Janice who says, "Well, Clement, it's so good to hear the mayor on the show. She's one of the kindest humans I've ever met. She was a schoolmate with my sister, my older sister, Ko Loreto Convent, and lived in the same area, Komabopane. I'm really proud of her." That's what Janice says. So I wanted to ask you about how you keep focused as a mayor, because politics can be a dirty game, as you may well know. How do you allow yourself not to be distracted? And there are many things that happen. I remember the time when your office tweeted, when you had a strategic planning session, and then you had people like Tony Leon and Mike Helens also tweeting, you responded, and people felt how they responded was quite condescending and rude. How do you protect yourself from being too affected by the politics and just focus on the job?
Yeah, so before I started my campaign, we were in the lockdown, and during that time I did a course in corporate coaching.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was doing it because, you know, I was at MMC, and then I was just an ordinary PR counselor, and I had so much time on my hands, and I thought I'm doing it for an extra income and sort of thing. But I actually realized it was actually preparing me for this role, because it happened just before the campaign. And mm-hmm. one of the things you do, you focus on, of course, is emotional intelligence. And, you know, it's got the four quadrants: self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, and relationship management. And I think what your question talks to the first two. So being self-aware in any situation, whether it's hostile or friendly, you need to be aware of yourself and how it's affecting you and how you are reacting or how you feel like reacting to it. And self-management then is, okay, we are here, I feel like this, what do I do? Mm. You know, and going back to the Tony Leon tweet, what people may not know is that it was the third time.
Oh, was it the third?
Yes. So he did it once and I ignored it. I ignored it because Tony Leon used to be party leader of the party that I belonged to. And for me, I should see him as an elder, you know. Mm. He was an elder. And I thought, let me leave the elder. He erred. You know, I thought he made a mistake. Second time, I ignored him again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was the third time, and this is on a short space of time, and I realized, okay, we're dealing with a bigger problem here, and it looks like he's not going to stop. Mm. So at that time, I made a conscious decision to address it, because I realized if I didn't address it, it was not going to stop. And so the first two times, I made a conscious decision to ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where self-management comes in. And I'm happy to say I haven't had a similar incident since the third time.
But what did that make you... How did you read that? Because people like him and Mashaba felt that it was not a coincidence or just a random act or just an error, but it was another strategy to sabotage and maybe even collapse the administration. We know Tony Leon's influence within the DA. I mean, he's one of the people that wrote that report about Musi Maimane. Where is Musi now? So when they speak, like, people do listen. Do you think there was something intentional about that tweet and how maybe it was coordinated together with how Michael Waters also responded?
I definitely think the other tweets around it were coordinated. Mm-hmm. I think if you look closely, it would certainly be people were connected to each other. Whether or not there was more to it, I don't want to presume. You know, it was a service delivery related tweet. The others, maybe not so much. I mean, there was one about, there was a really low-key suggesting that I could be xenophobic,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, I resented that, but I still chose not to respond, because I think that was the second one or the first, I can't remember. But this one was about service delivery, it was about potholes. So if I choose to ignore all the noise and everything else, I could say he's probably really concerned about potholes, but went about it the wrong way, or mm-hmm. went about showing it the wrong way,
mm-hmm.
right? But others have their own hypotheses, which I will not take away from them, but that was not something I jumped to. I was just disappointed that for somebody of his caliber, I would have expected a more constructive engagement. Why? Because the tweet presupposed, A, that there's a false dichotomy between having planning sessions and doing work, when actually you must do both. I mean, I studied project management and program management, and one of the biggest lessons I took out of it is you plan the work before you work the plan, you know, and that was the first thing. The second thing was that he also assumed that nothing was being done about potholes, when in fact, by that time, I had already contacted the MMC saying there's a problem here. We had already started looking at the data very closely, analyzing it to find out exactly what the issues are. We were already diagnosing the problem as a transversal problem that, you know, we've put it narrowly within the Joburg Roads Agency to manage potholes. But actually, there's so many codependencies with other departments. And there was a concerted effort. I had already called a meeting of different MMCs to look at their role in assisting the GRA to fight this war against potholes. But his tweet presupposed that all I do is sit in planning meetings and I'm not doing any work. So it was so ill-informed. And for somebody of his caliber, I was really disappointed.
Did the party support you?
I mean, yes, I did. I did get support. I mean, Helen reached out to me personally, even before she sent out her tweet. She said to me, "No, I'm really disappointed, and don't worry, we're dealing with it, we're managing it." So I felt very supported by the party.
Okay. You've been in office now, leading the coalition government for, is it 7 or 8 months now? Somewhere there, right? It's not Pap'nHlaise leading a coalition government, because you've got political parties that have their own interests. How has it been for you, especially because at a negotiation level, you're not so involved? It's parties that talk about, right, the setup of the coalition. You are the mayor running the administration. And I wonder if sometimes you feel like, I don't have control over that, and therefore that somehow also influences how I do this. How has it been for you over the last couple of months?
So it's been very interesting. I think I'm being stretched in all kinds of ways. I mean, I expected it, but I don't think I understood the extent of some of the challenges. You know, you've got 9 political parties. It's unprecedented in South Africa. I think Helen was mayor over 7 political parties in Cape Town. And I don't think we've had anything above that. So this is unprecedented. You've got parties that have diametrically opposing views on some issues, and you've got to manage that, find each other, find consensus, and govern. One good thing about the coalition is we all want to take over in 2024. We want to see the ANC out of power, and we want to see a coalition government at provincial level, in various parts of the country, and at national level. So that keeps us together and it holds us together. So it has been challenging. So the stages of, I think it's Tuckman that defines the stages of team development, is forming, norming, storming. I mean, forming, storming, norming. Performing. Now, I would say we at the tail end of the storming phase, where we're finding each other, or we're finding our rhythm. You know, if I were to call it a choreographed dance, we're finding our rhythm. You know, we're coming in with different expectations, different political ideologies, and we have to dance, we have to dance in unison.
Yeah. Do you sometimes feel like parties, especially at that negotiation level, sometimes compromise governance? Because negotiations, as I said, happen at a party level. You are not involved. Hence, you would hear people like Action SA accuse the DA of being arrogant, you know, and then people threaten to walk away from the coalition and it's out of your control. And I often ask the question on the show whether our political system and even political parties are mature enough to be part of a coalition government. And by mature, I mean realize that we need to put the interests of South Africans first. Yes, we may have these ideological differences, but right now, South Africans didn't vote any of us with an overwhelming majority. They forced us to work with each other, and that needs to be the focus. Do you sometimes worry about those negotiations at party level? Right. And some of the parties not willing to concede on things, and then some people threaten to walk away, and that compromises on the broader coalition government.
Coalition governance is hard work. It is a full-time job. That was one of the first pieces of advice that I got from Helen. You know, you've got to manage relationships and you've got to manage the coalition, the whole, and make sure that the center is holding. So, yes, you you put together a coalition agreement because you've got a common vision. You want to govern and you want to have a stable majority government. A lot of the times, prospectively, there's a lot that you don't see as yet. And so what we find is we're having to review and revise as we're seeing practically how things are playing out on the ground. For instance, we've had to define certain things. So can the coalition agreement be above the laws of this country? Is a good example. No, it can't. So if legislation says the mayor is expected to do 1, 2, 3, you cannot say in terms of the coalition agreement, the mayor must not do that, you know? Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of things we're defining now. And I think it's a good exercise because I think we're perfecting coalition governance. 2016 was kind of a new phenomenon in our setting. And I mean, I remember I was part of the government then. We didn't even have the kind of coalition agreement that we have now. And when our governments collapsed in 2019, the DA was very intentional about starting to put together a group of people to work on conceptualizing what a good coalition agreement should look like, what sort of clauses should be included in there. And I think collectively with the partners, they've really come out with a good coalition agreement, but it's still not without gaps, and it's work in progress. As we identify those gaps, we are filling them. I don't think that there's a perfect coalition. I think that there is a perfect vision, and if the coalition partners adhere to the idea of realizing the perfect vision, they can make the coalition work.
What do you think have been your, if I asked you since you took over as mayor of Johannesburg, three things that you think are your biggest achievement? What have you been able to do as mayor that you look back and you say, there we are making a difference as this DA-led coalition?
So I think for me, the first big win was being able to form a stable government. You know, because I was voted in, we had 26% of the vote. And we knew, that's why it took us 3 weeks to appoint MMCs. We knew that that's not sustainable. It's a government that was likely not to last. So that for me was a big win. You know, I didn't expect it to have 9 political parties, but it is what it is, and we're making it work. The second thing is the electricity crisis. I think we made some headway there. You know, we held our 2-day energy indaba in May as promised to our residents. We brought in the private sector. We've started the conversation. City Power is about to issue a request for proposals. So that work is underway.
But
so
what's tangible? What's come out of that? That's like, you know, I hear you. It's a conversation and things still need to happen. But I'm asking about like practical things that you can say, that's what we've been able to do.
So it is practical. And yeah. I know what you're saying. You're saying, well, I can't see it.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you want to talk about things you've seen, there'll be a lot, right? We've refurbished over 100 buses, for instance. We've filled critical vacancies. We've replaced the boards of all the entities. Mm. I'm trying to think in all the different... We've issued title deeds. We've given out... We've done sod turning for social housing projects. There's a lot of bits and pieces of work that's happening in the various spaces. But I think if you look at a sick city, you need to really look at a systemic level. What is it systemically that we need to address? And that's really been the focus of our government. Not neglecting the small deliverables like cleanups and all the other things that I've mentioned. We opened a reservoir. I mean, this reservoir, we set aside the budget when we were still in government, and it was only completed now, and we opened it about 2-3 weeks ago. So it was huge, you know, for the South. They at least have reserves for water supply and all of that. So there's a lot that I can give you, but I think we were concerned about let's bring Joburg back to health and bring the institution first to a state where it can serve its people well. And it means cleaning up. It means getting the right leadership in place. It means having internal controls, making sure that there's financial sustainability, there's oversight, there's consequence management, we're fighting corruption. So we've had a lot of those kind of things that we've been focusing on, and we've made some great headway. And I call it a foundation. When you're building a house and you're busy with your foundation, it doesn't look pretty, you know, and people might even say nothing is happening. But in fact, that's the most important part of any building. And in the few months that we've been in office, I'd say we've really been dealing with the foundations of the city of Johannesburg. I'm excited because now with our new budget having loaded on the 1st of July, people are already starting to see the change, and there's very positive reviews throughout the city. People are thanking me everywhere I go, whether it's the grocery store, people are saying, thank you, we see it. So yeah, definitely something good is happening.
Are you one of those that are thanking the mayor? I'm going to take your calls after the break. Charles, James, Ivan, I see you. I see your WhatsApp voice notes as well. Going straight to them after that.
Hanging out with Clement on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
All right, let's go to your calls. Let's start with Charles in Johannesburg. Charles, good morning.
Morning. I just want to say, my mayor, I'm one of the firefighters of Sweet Hope Joburg. Most of the administration failed to get fire engine for us. I'll be a happy person if she can organize even 5 fire engines for us.
Wait, so you're a firefighter in the city. Sorry, Charles, your line is not the best. You're a firefighter in the city, and you are saying you are short of fire engines and you need more investments of fire engines. Am I getting you right?
Yes, as you know, Clement, always we're talking about this thing of fire engines in the city.
Yeah.
So if she can organize, maybe even 5, I'll be a happy person.
Ah, wonderful. Thank you for the call, Charles. Mayor, Charles is a firefighter and he says, give us more fire engines.
Hello, Charles. So lovely hearing from you, but so good to hear. You're so passionate about what you do. You actually just want the tools to be able to perform. Well, the good news, Charles, is that there is funding in this financial year to get 10 fire engines. And we know that that's not enough, but it's an installment and we'll keep investing. So you'll be encouraged to hear. Hopefully one of them's coming your way.
And will Charles, give me a call again. If the mayor doesn't bring them in that time, call me. So we can call her and say, hey, you made a commitment on air. James in Joburg, hi. James.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My name is James, and I'm here at an industrial area in Joburg. So, Mayor, can you please help us? Like, we did help ourselves. When we came here at some stage, there were illegal people on the pavement here on our street. We moved them. We knew it was illegal, but we moved them out. We put our own security with our own people who are cleaning the street of Joburg. Our area is fine, it's clean. But those people, they moved underneath N Street. So if you go underneath N Street, there were a lot of illegal people who are staying there. On the street, the water is just in a mess. When can you come or take the same principle that we applied here and then use it at N Street and move those illegal people?
All right, James in Joburg, thank you. Mayor?
Thank you so much, James. I will definitely be taking your details and we will get in touch with you and go and see what you're talking about and deal with it. We've got a lot of people living on the streets of Johannesburg. As you know, Johannesburg is perceived as the city of gold. Well, it is, and that's what we're rebuilding and restoring. But people come here with expectations of finding jobs. Unfortunately, with the economy where it is now, we're not able to absorb all of them into the job market. And a lot of those people end up living on the street. It's a challenge. We do have homeless shelters that we've rolled out. We do have various other interventions through our law enforcement agency, the JMPD, and other law enforcement. But where there is more that can be done, we want to do it. So we will definitely take your details.
Yeah, let's take James' details and give them to the mayor's team. Ivan in Kensington, go ahead. Hi.
We just want to salute you, Dr. Palatse, Mayor of Johannesburg. Your dedication, your passion, your enthusiasm is awakening so many of us, and we're so thrilled to have people like yourselves. You are now part of my dream team, you and Dr. Tuli Madonsela, and I promise you, you guys better start getting into politics and parliament. And with leaders like you, we've got a sure future in South Africa.
All right, Ivan in Kensington, thank you. Let's take some voice notes as well.
Hi, Clement. Thank you for bringing our mayor. She is undoubtedly the best we've had so far since 94, and probably the best ever for the city of Johannesburg. And I'm so glad I voted for her, even though I'm not a DA supporter or a DA member, but I've just voted for her because I've always liked her as an individual. And I really also, I was drawn to her, especially during the local government elections last year, where she stood out and was brave enough to go against the rest of the DA leaders on the Phoenix poster. She spoke out against it. And I also like her humility. I mean, if you listen to the ongoing radio now, she doesn't read radio ad. She doesn't address herself as Dr. Mpo Palatse. She just says, I'm Mpo Palatse. Thanks. Farai.
Thank you, Farai.
Good morning, Clement. Good morning, Mpho. My name is Bongani Nkomo. I'm actually a councillor in the city of Joburg under the leadership of Mpho Palatse. I just want to say that what many people don't know about our executive mayor is that she's an absolute warrior. And I think it's a privilege to be led by her. And she inspires so much confidence, you know, within the caucus, but also within the city. And I just want to give her flowers while she's still around to smell them and just say to her that it's an absolute pleasure to be led by her and we are fully behind her.
Hi, Clement. It's Matapelo. Listening to Mpho Palatse, wow, what a good story. Wow, what a great lady. You know, a lady, when we talk about a lady, we're talking about Mpho Palatse. I'm wishing her all the best and she mustn't give up. Even if they can throw her with stones, whatever that they can throw her, she must just hang in there.
All right. Thank you so much for that. Mayor, last question. What do you want to, by the time you finish your term, and hopefully you do, and there's no instability, what would you say are the two or three things that you would have wanted to achieve?
The first thing is energy stability in the city. No more load shedding, no more energy outages, affordable energy for all, whether you're in an informal settlement or in a formalized area, no more illegal connections. I mean, it's all related. Secondly, socioeconomic empowerment of our people. I think the dependency on government is way above what it should be. Mm. It shouldn't be there. And people want to work, Clement. When you talk to people, people don't want handouts. You know, it takes away something from you when you have to depend on the state. People want jobs. I want to see the economy grow enough to create enough jobs for everybody to be able to take care of themselves and be part of the team that rebuilds the city. That's very, very important to me.
Dr. Mpho Palatse, Mayor of the City of Johannesburg, thank you so much for coming through this morning.
Thank you. Time really flew.
It did, right? Yeah. We'll have you back again to check on the promises and the commitments you've made. It's a minute before 11 o'clock.